The saddest period of my life. The next 4 years, between 1909 and 1913, turned out to be a time of utter misery and destitution for the conquering young man from Linz. In these last fleeting years before the fall of the Habsburgs, and the end of the city as the capital of an empire of 52 million people in the heart of Europe, Vienna had a gaiety and charm that were unique among the capitals of the world. Not only in its architecture, its sculpture, its music, but in the light-hearted, pleasure-loving, cultivated spirit of its people, it breathed an atmosphere of the Baroque and the Rococo that no other city of the West knew. Set along the blue Danube, beneath the wooded hills of the Wienerwald, which were studded with yellow-green vineyards, it was a place of natural beauty that captivated the visitor and made the Viennese believe that Providence had been especially kind to them. Music filled the air, the towering music of gifted native sons, the greatest Europe had known, Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, and Schubert. And in the last Indian summer years, the gay, haunting waltzes of Vienna's own beloved Johann Strauss. To a people so blessed and so imprinted with the Baroque style of living, life itself was something of a dream, and the good folk of the city passed the pleasant days and nights of their lives, waltzing and whining, in light talk in the congenial coffee houses, listening to music and viewing the make-believe of theater and opera and operetta, in flirting and making love, abandoning a large part of their lives to pleasure and to dreams. To be sure, an empire had to be governed, an army and navy manned, communications maintained, business transacted and labor done, but few in Vienna worked overtime, or even full-time, at such things. There was a seamy side, of course. This city, like all others, had its poor, ill-fed, ill-clothed, and living in hovels. But as the greatest industrial center in Central Europe, as well as the capital of the empire, Vienna was prosperous, and this prosperity spread among the people and sifted down. The great mass of the lower middle class controlled the city politically. Labor was organizing not only trade unions, but a powerful political party of its own, the Social Democrats. There was a ferment in the life of the city, now grown to a population of 2 million. Democracy was forcing out the ancient autocracy of the Habsburgs. Education and culture were opening up to the masses, so that by the time Hitler came to Vienna in 1909, there was opportunity for a penniless young man either to get a higher education or to earn a fairly decent living, and, as one of 1 million wage earners, to live under the civilizing spell which the capital cast over its inhabitants. Was not his only friend, Kubizek, as poor and as obscure as himself, already making a name for himself in the Academy of Music? But the young Adolf did not pursue his ambition to enter the School of Architecture. It was still open for him despite his lack of a high school diploma. Young men who showed special talent were admitted without such a certificate. But so far as is known, he made no application, nor was he interested in learning a trade or in taking any kind of regular employment. Instead, he preferred to putter about at odd jobs, shoveling snow, beating carpets, carrying bags outside the West Railroad station, occasionally for a few days working as a building laborer. In November 1909, less than a year after he arrived in Vienna to forestall fate, he was forced to abandon a furnished room in the Simon-Denk-Gasse, and for the next 4 years he lived in flophouses or in the almost equally miserable quarters of the men's hostel at 27 Meldemannstrasse in the 20th district of Vienna, near the Danube, staving off hunger by frequenting the charity soup kitchens of the city. No wonder that nearly 2 decades later he could write, "To me, Vienna, the city which to so many is the epitome of innocent pleasure, a festive playground for merrymakers, represents, I am sorry to say, merely the living memory of the saddest period of my life. Even today the city can arouse in me nothing but dismal thoughts. For me, the name of this fiacial city represents 5 years of hardship and misery, 5 years in which I was forced to earn a living, first as a day laborer, then as a small painter, a truly meager living which never sufficed to appease even my daily hunger. Always," he says of these times, "there was hunger. Hunger was then my faithful bodyguard. He never left me for a moment and partook of all I had. My life was a continual struggle with this pitiless friend. It never, however, drove him to the extremity of trying to find a regular job. As he makes clear in Mein Kampf, he had the petty bourgeoisie's gnawing fear of sliding back into the ranks of the proletariat, of the manual laborers, a fear he was later to exploit in building up the National Socialist Party on the broad foundation of the hitherto leaderless, ill-paid, neglected white-collar class, whose millions nourished the illusion that they were at least socially better off than the workers. Although Hitler says he eked out at least part of a living as a small painter, he gives no details of this work in his autobiography except to remark that in the years 1909 and 1910, he had so far improved his position that he no longer had to work as a common laborer. By this time, he says, I was working independently as a small draftsman and painter of watercolors. This is somewhat misleading, as is so much else of a biographical nature in Mein Kampf. Though the evidence of those who knew him at the time appears to be scarcely more trustworthy, enough of it has been pieced together to give a picture that is probably more accurate and certainly more complete. See Das Ende des Hitler-Mythos by Josef Greiner, who was personally acquainted with Hitler during part of his Vienna days. See also Hitler the Pawn by Rudolf Olden. Olden's book includes statements from Reinhold Hanisch, a Sudeten tramp who for a time was a roommate of Hitler's in the men's hostel and who hawked some of his paintings. Konrad Haydn, in Der Führer, also quotes material from Hanisch, including the court records of a lawsuit which Hitler brought against the tramp for cheating him out of a share of a painting which Hanisch allegedly sold for him. That Adolf Hitler was never a house painter, as his political opponents taunted him with having been, is fairly certain. At least there is no evidence that he ever followed such a trade. What he did was draw or paint crude little pictures of Vienna, usually of some well-known landmark such as St. Stephen's Cathedral, the Opera House, the Burgtheater, the Palace of Schönbrunn, or the Roman ruins in Schönbrunn Park. According to his acquaintances, he copied them from older works. Apparently, he could not draw from nature. They are rather stilted and lifeless, like a beginning architect's rough and careless sketches. And the human figures, he sometimes added, are so bad as to remind one of a comic strip. I find a note of my own made once after going through a portfolio of Hitler's original sketches. Few faces, crude, one almost ghoulish face. To Haydn, they stand like tiny stuffed sacks outside the high, solemn palaces. Probably hundreds of these pitiful pieces were sold by Hitler to the petty traders to ornament a wall, to dealers who used them to fill empty picture frames on display, and to furniture makers who sometimes tacked them to the backs of cheap sofas and chairs after a fashion in Vienna in those days. Hitler could also be more commercial. He often drew posters for shopkeepers advertising such products as Teddy's perspiration powder. And there was one, perhaps turned out to make a little money at Christmas time, depicting Santa Claus selling brightly colored candles, and another showing St. Stephen's Gothic spire, which Hitler never tired of copying, rising out of a mountain of soap cakes. This was the extent of Hitler's artistic achievement, yet to the end of his life he considered himself an artist. Bohemian, he certainly looked in those vagabond years in Vienna. Those who knew him then remembered later his long black shabby overcoat, which hung down to his ankles and resembled a caftan, and which had been given him by a Hungarian Jewish old clothes dealer, a fellow inmate of the dreary men's hostel who had befriended him. They remembered his greasy black derby, which he wore the year round, his matted hair brushed down over his forehead, as in later years, and, in the back, hanging disheveled over his soiled collar, for he rarely appeared to have had a haircut or a shave, and the sides of his face and chin were usually covered with the black stubble of an incipient beard. If one can believe Hanisch, who later became something of an artist, Hitler resembled an apparition such as rarely occurs among Christians. Unlike some of the shipwrecked young men with whom he lived, he had none of the vices of youth. He neither smoked nor drank. He had nothing to do with women, not so far as can be learned because of any abnormality, but simply because of an ingrained shyness. I believe, Hitler remarked afterward in Mein Kampf in one of his rare flashes of humor, that those who knew me in those days took me for an eccentric. They remembered, as had his teachers, the strong, staring eyes that dominated the face and expressed something embedded in the personality that did not jibe with the miserable existence of the unwashed tramp. And they recalled that the young man, for all his laziness when it came to physical labor, was a voracious reader, spending much of his days and evenings devouring books. At that time I read enormously and thoroughly. All the free time my work left me was employed in my studies. In this way I forged in a few years' time the foundations of a knowledge from which I still draw nourishment today. In Mein Kampf, Hitler discourses at length on the art of reading. By reading, to be sure, I mean perhaps something different than the average member of our so-called intelligentsia. I know people who read enormously, yet whom I would not describe as well-read. True, they possess a mass of knowledge, but their brain is unable to organize and register the material they have taken in. On the other hand, a man who possesses the art of correct reading will instinctively and immediately perceive everything which in his opinion is worth permanently remembering, either because it is suited to his purpose or generally worth knowing. The art of reading, as of learning, is this: to retain the essential, to forget the non-essential. Only this kind of reading has meaning and purpose. Viewed in this light, my Vienna period was especially fertile and valuable. Valuable for what? Hitler's answer is that from his reading and from his life among the poor and disinherited of Vienna, he learned all that he needed to know in later life. Vienna was and remained for me the hardest, the most thorough school of my life. I had set foot in this town while still half a boy, and I left it a man, grown quiet and grave. In this period there took shape within me a world picture and a philosophy which became the granite foundation of all my acts. In addition to what I then created, I have had to learn little, and I have had to alter nothing. What, then, had he learned in the school of those hard knocks which Vienna had so generously provided? What were the ideas which he acquired there from his reading and his experience, and which, as he says, would remain essentially unaltered to the end? That they were mostly shallow and shabby, often grotesque and preposterous, and poisoned by outlandish prejudices, will become obvious on the most cursory examination. That they are important to this history, as they were to the world, is equally obvious, for they were to form part of the foundation for the Third Reich, which this bookish vagrant was soon to build. This book is continued on Disc 2. The budding ideas of Adolf Hitler. They were, with one exception, not original, but picked up, raw, from the churning maelstrom of Austrian politics and life in the first years of the 20th century. The Danube monarchy was dying of indigestion. For centuries, a minority of German Austrians had ruled over the polyglot empire of a dozen nationalities and stamped their language and their culture on it. But since 1848, their hold had been weakening. The minorities could not be digested. Austria was not a melting pot. In the 1860s, the Italians had broken away, and in 1867, the Hungarians had won equality with the Germans under a so-called dual monarchy. Now, as the 20th century began, the various Slav peoples, the Czechs, the Slovaks, the Serbs, the Croats, and the others, were demanding equality and at least national autonomy. Austrian politics had become dominated by the bitter quarrel of the nationalities. But this was not all. There was social revolt, too, and this often transcended the racial struggle. The disenfranchised lower classes were demanding the ballot, and the workers were insisting on the right to organize trade unions and to strike, not only for higher wages and better working conditions, but to gain their democratic political ends. Indeed, a general strike had finally brought universal manhood suffrage, and with this the end of political dominance by the Austrian Germans, who numbered but a third of the population of the Austrian half of the empire. To these developments Hitler, the fanatical young German-Austrian nationalist from Linz, was bitterly opposed. To him the empire was sinking into a foul morass. It could be saved only if the master race, the Germans, reasserted their old absolute authority. The non-German races, especially the Slavs and above all the Czechs, were an inferior people. It was up to the Germans to rule them with an iron hand. The parliament must be abolished and an end put to all the democratic nonsense. Though he took no part in politics, Hitler followed avidly the activities of the three major political parties of old Austria. The Social Democrats, the Christian Socialists, and the Pan-German Nationalists. And there now began to sprout in the mind of this unkempt frequenter of the soup kitchens a political shrewdness which enabled him to see with amazing clarity the strengths and weaknesses of contemporary political movements, and which, as it matured, would make him the master politician of Germany. At first contact, he developed a furious hatred for the party of the Social Democrats. "What most repelled me," he says, "was its hostile attitude toward the struggle for the preservation of Germanism and its disgraceful courting of the Slavic comrade. In a few months I obtained what might have otherwise required decades, an understanding of a pestilential whore, cloaking herself as social virtue and brotherly love." The word whore was cut out in the second and all subsequent editions of Mein Kampf, and the noun pestilence substituted. And yet he was already intelligent enough to quench his feelings of rage against this party of the working class in order to examine carefully the reasons for its popular success. He concluded that there were several reasons, and years later he was to remember them and utilize them in building up the National Socialist Party of Germany. One day, he recounts in Mein Kampf, he witnessed a mass demonstration of Viennese workers. "For nearly 2 hours I stood there watching with bated breath the gigantic human dragon slowly winding by. In oppressed anxiety I finally left the place and sauntered homeward." At home he began to read the Social Democratic press, examine the speeches of its leaders, study its organization, reflect on its psychology and political techniques, and ponder the results. He came to three conclusions which explained to him the success of the Social Democrats. They knew how to create a mass movement, without which any political party was useless. They had learned the art of propaganda among the masses. And finally, they knew the value of using what he calls spiritual and physical terror. This third lesson, though it was surely based on faulty observation and compounded of his own immense prejudices, intrigued the young Hitler. Within 10 years, he would put it to good use for his own ends. "I understood the infamous spiritual terror which this movement exerts, particularly on the bourgeoisie, which is neither morally nor mentally equal to such attacks. At a given sign, it unleashes a veritable barrage of lies and slanders against whatever adversary seems most dangerous, until the nerves of the attacked persons break down. This is a tactic based on precise calculation of all human weaknesses, and its result will lead to success with almost mathematical certainty. I achieved an equal understanding of the importance of physical terror toward the individual and the masses. For while in the ranks of their supporters, the victory achieved seems a triumph of the justice of their own cause, the defeated adversary, in most cases, despairs of the success of any further resistance." No more precise analysis of Nazi tactics, as Hitler was eventually to develop them, was ever written. There were two political parties which strongly attracted the fledgling Hitler in Vienna, and to both of them he applied his growing power of shrewd, cold analysis. His first allegiance, he says, was to the Pan-German Nationalist Party, founded by Georg Ritter von Schirnerer, who came from the same region near Spital in Lower Austria as had Hitler's family. The Pan-Germans at that time were engaged in a last-ditch struggle for German supremacy in the multinational empire. And though Hitler thought that Schirnerer was a profound thinker and enthusiastically embraced his basic program of violent nationalism, anti-Semitism, anti-socialism, union with Germany, and opposition to the Habsburgs and the Holy See, he quickly sized up the causes for the party's failure. "This movement's inadequate appreciation of the importance of the social problem cost it the truly militant mass of the people. Its entry into Parliament took away its mighty impetus and burdened it with all the weaknesses peculiar to this institution. the struggle against the Catholic Church robbed it of countless of the best elements that the nation can call its own. Though Hitler was to forget it when he came to power in Germany, one of the lessons of his Vienna years which he stresses at great length in Mein Kampf is the futility of a political party's trying to oppose the churches. Regardless of how much room for criticism there was in any religious denomination, he says, in explaining why Schirnerer's Los von Rom, away from Rome movement, was a tactical error, a political party must never for a moment lose sight of the fact that in all previous historical experience, a purely political party has never succeeded in producing a religious reformation. But it was the failure of the Pan-Germans to arouse the masses, their inability to even understand the psychology of the common people, that to Hitler constituted their biggest mistake. It is obvious from his recapitulation of the ideas that began to form in his mind when he was not much past the age of 21, that to him this was the cardinal error. He was not to repeat it when he founded his own political movement. There was another mistake of the Pan-Germans which Hitler was not to make. That was the failure to win over the support of at least some of the powerful established institutions of the nation. If not the church, then the army, say, or the cabinet, or the head of state. Unless a political movement gained such backing, the young man saw, it would be difficult if not impossible for it to assume power. This support was precisely what Hitler had the shrewdness to arrange for in the crucial January days of 1933 in Berlin, and what alone made it possible for him and his National Socialist Party to take over the rule of a great nation. There was one political leader in Vienna in Hitler's time who understood this, as well as the necessity of building a party on the foundation of the masses. This was Dr. Karl Lueger, the burgomaster of Vienna and leader of the Christian Social Party, who, more than any other, became Hitler's political mentor, though the two never met. Hitler always regarded him as the greatest German mayor of all times, a statesman greater than all the so-called diplomats of the time. If Dr. Karl Lueger had lived in Germany, he would have been ranked among the great minds of our people. There was, to be sure, little resemblance between Hitler, as he later became, and this big, bluff, genial idol of the Viennese lower middle classes. It is true that Lueger became the most powerful politician in Austria as the head of a party which was drawn from the disgruntled petty bourgeoisie and which made political capital, as Hitler later did, out of a raucous anti-Semitism. But Lueger, who had risen from modest circumstances and worked his way through the university, was a man of considerable intellectual attainments, and his opponents, including the Jews, readily conceded that he was at heart a decent, chivalrous, generous, and tolerant man. Stefan Zweig, the eminent Austrian Jewish writer, who was growing up in Vienna at this time, has testified that Lueger never allowed his official anti-Semitism to stop him from being helpful and friendly to the Jews. His city administration, Zweig recounted, was perfectly just and even typically democratic. The Jews who had trembled at this triumph of the anti-Semitic party continued to live with the same rights and esteem as always. This the young Hitler did not like. He thought Lueger was far too tolerant and did not appreciate the racial problem of the Jews. He resented the mayor's failure to embrace Pan-Germanism and was skeptical of his Roman Catholic clericalism and his loyalty to the Habsburgs. Had not the old Emperor Franz Joseph twice refused to sanction Lueger's election as burgomaster? But in the end, Hitler was forced to acknowledge the genius of this man who knew how to win the support of the masses, who understood modern social problems and the importance of propaganda and oratory in swaying the multitude. Hitler could not help but admire the way Lueger dealt with the powerful church. His policy was fashioned with infinite shrewdness. And finally, Lueger was quick to make use of all available means for winning the support of long-established institutions, so as to be able to derive the greatest possible advantage for his movement from those old sources of power. Here, in a nutshell, were the ideas and techniques which Hitler was later to use in constructing his own political party and in leading it to power in Germany. His originality lay in his being the only politician of the right to apply them to the German scene after the First World War. It was then that the Nazi movement, alone among the nationalist and conservative parties, gained a great mass following, and having achieved this, won over the support of the army, the President of the Republic, and the associations of big business, three long-established institutions of great power, which led to the chancellorship of Germany. The lessons learned in Vienna proved useful indeed. Dr. Karl Luger had been a brilliant orator, but the Pan-German Party had lacked effective public speakers. Hitler took notice of this, and in Mein Kampf makes much of the importance of oratory in politics. The power which has always started the greatest religious and political avalanches in history rolling has, from time immemorial, been the magic power of the spoken word, and that alone. The broad masses of the people can be moved only by the power of speech. All great movements are popular movements, volcanic eruptions of human passions and emotional sentiments, stirred either by the cruel goddess of distress or by the firebrand of the word hurled among the masses. They are not the lemonade-like outpourings of the literary aesthetes and drawing-room heroes. Though refraining from actual participation in Austrian party politics, young Hitler already was beginning to practice his oratory on the audiences which he found in Vienna's flophouses, soup kitchens, and on its street corners. It was to develop into a talent, as this author, who later was to listen to scores of his most important speeches, can testify, more formidable than any other in the Germany between the wars, and it was to contribute in a large measure to his astounding success. And finally, in Hitler's Vienna experience, there were the Jews. In Linz, he says, there had been few Jews. At home, I do not remember having heard the word during my father's lifetime. At high school, there was a Jewish boy, but we didn't give the matter any thought. I even took them, the Jews, for Germans. According to Hitler's boyhood friend, this is not the truth. When I first met Adolf Hitler, says August Kubizek, recalling their days together in Linz, his anti-Semitism was already pronounced. Hitler was already a confirmed anti-Semite when he went to Vienna. And although his experiences in Vienna might have deepened this feeling, they certainly did not give birth to it. Then, says Hitler, I came to Vienna. Preoccupied by the abundance of my impressions, oppressed by the hardship of my own lot, I gained at first no insight into the inner stratification of the people of this gigantic city. Notwithstanding that Vienna in those days counted nearly 200,000 Jews among its 2 million inhabitants, I did not see them. The Jew was still characterized for me by nothing but his religion, and therefore on grounds of human tolerance I maintained my rejection of religious attacks in this case as in others. Consequently, the tone of the Viennese anti-Semitic press seemed to me unworthy of the cultural tradition of a great nation. One day, Hitler recounts, he went strolling through the inner city. I suddenly encountered an apparition in a black caftan and black sidelocks. Is this a Jew? Was my first thought, for to be sure they had not looked like that in Linz. I observed the man furtively and cautiously, but the longer I stared at this foreign face, scrutinizing feature for feature, the more my first question assumed a new form. Is this a German? Hitler's answer may be readily guessed. He claims, though, that before answering he decided to try to relieve my doubts by books. He buried himself in anti-Semitic literature, which had a large sale in Vienna at the time. Then he took to the streets to observe the phenomenon more closely. Wherever I went, he says, I began to see Jews, and the more I saw, the more sharply they became distinguished in my eyes from the rest of humanity. Later I often grew sick to the stomach from the smell of these caftan wearers. Next, he says, he discovered the moral stain on this chosen people. Was there any form of filth or profligacy, particularly in cultural life, without at least one Jew involved in it? If you cut even cautiously into such an abscess, you found, like a maggot in a rotting body, often dazzled by the sudden light, a kike. The Jews were largely responsible, he says he found, for prostitution and the white slave traffic. When for the first time, he relates, I recognized the Jew as the cold-hearted, shameless, and calculating director of this revolting vice traffic in the scum of the big city, a cold shudder ran down my back. There is a great deal of morbid sexuality in Hitler's ravings about the Jews. This was characteristic of Vienna's anti-Semitic press of the time, as it later was to be of the obscene Nuremberg weekly Der Stürmer, published by one of Hitler's favorite cronies, Julius Streicher, Nazi boss of Franconia, a noted pervert and one of the most unsavory characters in the Third Reich. Mein Kampf is sprinkled with lurid allusions to uncouth Jews seducing innocent Christian girls and thus adulterating their blood. Hitler can write of the nightmare vision of the seduction of hundreds of thousands of girls by repulsive, crooked-legged Jew bastards. As Rudolf Olden has pointed out, one of the roots of Hitler's anti-Semitism may have been his tortured sexual envy. Though he was in his early 20s, so far as is known, he had no relations of any kind with women during his sojourn in Vienna. Gradually, Hitler relates, I began to hate them. For me, this was the time of the greatest spiritual upheaval I have ever had to go through. I had ceased to be a weak-kneed cosmopolitan and become an anti-Semite. He was to remain a blind and fanatical one to the bitter end. His last testament, written a few hours before his death, would contain a final blast against the Jews as responsible for the war which he had started, and which was now finishing him and the Third Reich. This burning hatred, which was to infect so many Germans in that empire, would lead ultimately to a massacre so horrible and on such a scale as to leave an ugly scar on civilization that will surely last as long as man on earth. In the spring of 1913, Hitler left Vienna for good and went to live in Germany, where his heart, he says, had always been. He was 24, and to everyone except himself, he must have seemed a total failure. He had not become a painter nor an architect. He had become nothing, so far as anyone could see, but a vagabond, an eccentric, bookish one, to be sure. He had no friends, no family, no job, no home. He had, however, one thing, an unquenchable confidence in himself and a deep, burning sense of mission. Probably he left Austria to escape military service. This was not because he was a coward, but because he loathed the idea of serving in the ranks with Jews, Slavs, and other minority races of the empire. Since 1910, when he was 21, he had been subject to military service. According to Haydn, the Austrian authorities could not put their finger on him while he was in Vienna. They finally located him in Munich and ordered him to report for examination in Linz. Josef Greiner, in his Das Ende des Hitler-Mythos, publishes some of the correspondence between Hitler and the Austrian military authorities in which Hitler denies that he went to Germany to avoid Austrian military service. On the ground that he lacked funds, he requested to be allowed to take his examination in Salzburg because of its nearness to Munich. He was examined there on February 5, 1914, and found unfit for military or even auxiliary service on account of poor health. Apparently, he still had a lung ailment. His failure to report for military service until the authorities finally located him at the age of 24 must have bothered Hitler when his star rose in Germany. Greiner confirms a story that was current in anti-Nazi circles when I was in Berlin, that when the German troops occupied Austria in 1938, Hitler ordered the Gestapo to find the official papers relating to his military service. The records in Linz were searched in vain, to Hitler's mounting fury. They had been removed by a member of the local government who, after the war, showed them to Greiner. In Mein Kampf, Hitler states that he went to Munich in the spring of 1912, but this is an error. A police register lists him as living in Vienna until May 1913. His own stated reasons for leaving Austria are quite grandiose. My inner revulsion toward the Habsburg state steadily grew. I was repelled by the conglomeration of races which the capital showed me, repelled by this whole mixture of Czechs, Poles, Hungarians, Ruthenians, Serbs, and Croats, and everywhere the eternal mushroom of humanity, Jews, and more Jews. To me the giant city seemed the embodiment of racial desecration. The longer I lived in the city, the more my hatred grew for the foreign mixture of peoples which had begun to corrode this old site of German culture. For all these reasons, a longing rose stronger and stronger in me to go at last whither since my childhood secret desires and secret love had drawn me. His destiny in that land he loved so dearly was to be such as not even he, in his wildest dreams, could have then imagined. He was and would remain until shortly before he became chancellor, technically a foreigner, an Austrian, in the German Reich. It is only as an Austrian who came of age in the last decade before the collapse of the Habsburg Empire, who failed to take root in its civilized capital, who embraced all the preposterous prejudices and hates then rife among its German-speaking extremists, and who failed to grasp what was decent and honest and honorable in the vast majority of his fellow citizens, were they Czechs or Jews or Germans, poor or well-off, artists or artisans, that Hitler can be understood. It is doubtful if any German from the north, from the Rhineland in the west, from East Prussia, or even from Bavaria in the south, could have had in his blood and mind out of any possible experience exactly the mixture of ingredients which propelled Adolf Hitler to the heights he eventually reached. To be sure, there was added a liberal touch of unpredictable genius. But in the spring of 1913, his genius had not yet shown. In Munich, as in Vienna, he remained penniless, friendless, and without a regular job. And then in the summer of 1914, the war came, snatching him, like millions of others, into its grim clutches. On August 3rd, he petitioned King Ludwig III of Bavaria for permission to volunteer in a Bavarian regiment, and it was granted. This was the heaven-sent opportunity. Now the young vagabond could satisfy not only his passion to serve his beloved adopted country in what he says he believed was a fight for its existence, to be or not to be, but he could escape from all the failures and frustrations of his personal life. "To me," he wrote in Mein Kampf, "those hours came as a deliverance from the distress that had weighed upon me during the days of my youth. I am not ashamed to say that, carried away by the enthusiasm of the moment, I sank down on my knees and thanked heaven out of the fullness of my heart for granting me the good fortune of being permitted to live in such a time. For me, as for every German, there now began the most memorable period of my life. Compared to the events of this gigantic struggle, all the past fell away into oblivion." For Hitler, the past, with all its shabbiness, loneliness, and disappointments, was to remain in the shadows, though it shaped his mind and character forever afterward. The war, which now would bring death to so many millions, brought for him, at 25, a new start in life.